Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison. I'll be your host for the next 45 minutes or so while we talk over recent developments in the world of public safety, labor, and employment relations. I want to start with a few housekeeping items. First of all, we've released our first complete webinar series, one on grievances and arbitration. You can find it on the LRIS website. We recorded them live with people participating using the chat feature on our meeting software, but you can still download them and listen to them. And of course, we'll answer any questions you might have about those webinars. We're in the middle of a week in which we're doing a six-part webinar on the rights of law enforcement officers. It's in conjunction with the release of the eighth edition of my book on the rights of law enforcement officers. I've recorded webinars so far this week on the police reform movement, the Garrity Rule, the Weingarten Rule, and one on the increasingly important issue of the sources of the law, where law enforcement officers, and by extension, firefighters and all public safety employees, where they are turning to find law that they think is more to their benefit. And there's some very surprising developments there. Tomorrow in the webinar, I'll be talking about the right to privacy, constitutional right to privacy, and then in the afternoon, the always popular Fair Labor Standards Act. Also, on a more personal note, I hate to report this, but last Thursday, our office was attacked again. You may remember that about 2 months ago, some people came by and threw bricks through the plate glass windows of our office and spray painted on the walls, actually on a garage door, in large red letters, the words KKOP. Lawyer scum. That happened a couple of months ago. Last Thursday, they came by and broke all the windows they hadn't broken the first time. And they also threw smoke bombs at the office. One of them made it into the office through a broken window. Thankfully, it landed in a cast iron tub, so it didn't catch the office on fire, although it charred the windowsill and the like. That's all, of course, deeply, deeply disappointing that this is where we are in the world today. But even beyond that, what's been demoralizing to me is I went on social media and saw comments and even engaged with some people on social media. And it's frightening to me that there are people who are out there who otherwise might be reasonable human beings who think that attacking my office is perfectly permissible because of who I represent. I wonder how they feel about criminal defense lawyers who represent people charged with murder. I don't mean to elevate the word too high by comparing what is going on here to other uses of the word, but attacking our office and making it clear that you're doing so because we represent police unions, that's an act of terrorism, right? It's meant to use fear to drive us out of the business of what we do. And I find that absolutely repulsive. And the notion that this is where we are in our society, very deeply disturbing. Anyway, I just wanted to share those thoughts with you. Obviously, this is not going to, they can attack this office as much as they want. They can burn it down, and it's not going to change what we do and what we've dedicated our lives to do. But it is something that it may put a little bit of a somber tenor on this podcast that I might not normally have. Before I get into the cases, the last thing I wanted to talk about was a feature of, yes, I'm recording this on Wednesday, yesterday's election. At the time I'm recording this, we don't know who the next president is going to be, although it seems to be, the votes seem to be shifting as they're counted in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Several states still been counted in Georgia, North Carolina, Arizona, Nevada, and all of those may end up determining who our president is. It's looking increasingly like it's going to be President Biden, but we already know that President Trump has vowed to challenge that election. So we're in for quite a bit of turmoil. I don't want to talk about any of that. I instead want to talk about the ballot measures that were out there on police issues. And I'm not going to talk about all of them because there were dozens of them around the country. But I do want to talk about the theme. And the theme is that these ballot measures are passing. Let me give you some examples. In California, I think the biggest one is a move to partially defund the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department by transferring money essentially from the Sheriff's Department to require investments in housing, mental health alternatives, and all sorts of people who are going to be creating these businesses to help in those areas. It's a huge transfer. It's a transfer of at least tens of millions of dollars, if not hundreds of millions of dollars. And it passed in Los Angeles County by a 57-43 margin. That's a massive. Los Angeles County, while it was up, decided to elect a reform district attorney, prosecutor. So life is going to be different there. And across California, you saw similar results. Oakland passed a ballot measure to strengthen its already existing civilian review board. San Jose expanded the authority of an auditor that they already have, giving subpoena authority to an oversight board and the like. And it's not just California. It's all over the country. In Columbus, the voters passed a measure to create a civilian review board in the position of inspector general. Here in Oregon, in Portland, the voters overwhelmingly passed a city charter amendment that would create a new citizens review board that would have the authority to discipline and fire officers. The night is young on that because there's, of course, very likely to be challenges to that. I'm not going to disclose any more about that, obviously. Even down in Texas, the small city, it doesn't have 50,000 people, of Kyle, Texas, voted to create a civilian review board by a 90-10 margin. And then up in King County, which is Seattle's county in California, a very striking vote to change the office of the sheriff from being an elected sheriff to being an appointed sheriff, with the notion being you have more control over an appointed sheriff. Try to wrap your brain around that for a moment. We want to deprive ourselves of the ability to elect a sheriff so that we can get more control over a sheriff who other people appoint. What's going on is very clear to me, and that is that if you put something that is labeled police reform on the ballot, in many parts of the country, it's going to pass. And it doesn't matter what the contents of it are, it is going to pass. It could be illegal, and some of these clearly, I think, are illegal. I think the Los Angeles County ballot measure certainly is illegal. It doesn't matter if it's well-written, doesn't matter if it's good policy. You put the words police reform, it's going to pass. And this is a harbinger of what 2021 is going to look like. Speaking now just to the police unions, you need to be out there and you need to be changing the way you're doing business. You need to be engaging at all levels of the community. You need to be engaging with people you don't agree with, people you may dislike. And you need to be engaged in politics at the state level, in your legislatures, so that you can deal with police reform issues in the legislature, some of which are introduced and passed on the same day. You need to be there in advance, preparing yourself for this sort of thing happening. And you need to be engaged with your local politicians. If you are a police union in this country, and you are not meeting with every one of your city council members multiple times a year, you are not doing your job. This doesn't mean you sit down and you talk to them about police business or police reform or any of that sort. So you can just go down to the local socially distanced Starbucks or wherever you might go and just sit down and talk about what Lewis Carroll used to call cabbages and kings. You need to build a relationship, because without those relationships, these sorts of things that passed yesterday are going to be done to you. You need to be a participant in the discussion. It is no longer good enough to stand off to the side, to emulate what you see from some big city police unions who are yelling and protesting and saying, all of the politicians, all of the people in this area of town hate us. It's not working. We are seeing fundamental changes in law enforcement. A lot of these changes are terrible. A lot of them are going to drive good people out of law enforcement. And we need to make sure that the changes that happen in the future are not just labels that are put on things, but are substantively positive and sound measures. Okay, a little bit of a rant over there. Now let's turn to the cases. I want to start with a couple of Brady cases that have come out. They're a little bit different than some Brady cases that we see. Certainly the first one of them is. The first one comes out of Massachusetts. And this is a big decision in Massachusetts. It comes out of a court that's known as the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. That's the Massachusetts Supreme Court. And here's what's going on in this case. It involves the city of Fall River, Massachusetts, and in particular, two officers. They're not named in the court's opinion. I'll just call them the officers. They were present when another police officer, Michael Pessoa, used force to arrest an individual in February of 2019. Pessoa submitted an arrest report concerning the arrest, but the other officers did not. But a few hours after the arrest, the officers were ordered by their supervisors to complete a standard form that the police department uses. It's called the Use of Defense Tactics Report. And why? Because when the arrestee was being booked at the police station, he had a bloody lip. Well, each of the officers created this form. They wrote out the form. And they, in essence, adopted Pessoa's version of the events as set forth in his incident report. And what Pessoa said was that the arrestee was noncompliant, threatened to punch the officers, and then was taken to the ground by Pessoa in making the arrest, and that's how the cut lip happened. The arrestee ended up getting charged with a variety of offenses, including resisting arrest, and in the course of preparing for trial, the defense attorney came up with a videotape of surveillance footage that showed the arrest and Pessoa's use of force. The defense attorney gave that to the district attorney, who looked at the video and said, we've got a problem. The footage of the incident was completely inconsistent with the description given both by Pessoa and the officers in their various reports. And what they showed was that the arrestee was completely compliant. When one of the officers removed his handcuffs, Pessoa struck the arrestee on the left side of his head and shoulder area, which caused the arrestee to be taken to the ground in a violent manner. So what does the DA do? The DA initiates a criminal investigation into Pessoa, and that investigation culminates with a grand jury. And the grand jury indicts Pessoa 15 separate counts in the indictment for conduct involving four separate arrestees. And the charges range from things like assault and battery by means of a dangerous weapon, civil rights violation, witness intimidation. You know, the list kind of goes on and on. During the grand jury, the district attorney subpoenas the officers to testify, and both of them came in and they asserted their rights for self-incrimination. And the DA is not going to let matters lie there. What he does is he files a couple of motions in trial court. It's called Superior Court in Massachusetts. And in the first motion, the DA asked authority from the court to disclose information from the grand jury testimony to defense counsel in other cases where either Pessoa or the officers would be potential witnesses in the cases. And you can imagine what the DA said in the motion. He said, look, I'm obligated to make these disclosures under Brady, but I got this information in grand jury, and grand jury proceedings are secret. So I need you, court, to authorize me to make this disclosure. And in the second motion, the district attorney asked for an order authorizing the disclosure of the information to the police chief in Fall River. And that results in litigation, and the whole case ends up before the Supreme Judicial Court. And the court ends up saying the DA should make these disclosures. And you know what? The DA doesn't even really need to ask us. The court says where a prosecutor determined that a police witness lied to conceal another officer's excessive use of force, the prosecutor has an obligation under Brady to disclose that information to defense counsel in any case where the officer is a potential witness or prepared a report in the criminal investigation. And the court goes on to say, if you're going to make this disclosure to defense counsel, obviously you can make it to the police chief or the police department. Why? Here's what the court says. The consequence of such disclosure is to jeopardize or at a minimum complicate the successful prosecution of any criminal case where the officer played a significant role. It would make no sense, the court says, for the prosecutor and defense counsel to possess this information and for the police chief to be deprived of the same information. The court goes on to say that the chief needs this information to decide whether to discipline or fire the officer, put the officer on desk duty, maybe take other steps to preserve the integrity of the department, and it's very clear that disclosure is permitted. And the court concludes by saying, because the disclosure arises from the prosecutor's Brady obligation, and I'm quoting here, no prior judicial approval is required to make this disclosure, even if it arises from immunized grand jury testimony. So what you're seeing from this court is the sense that, and it's prompted by, of course, terrible facts in this case, apparently obvious dishonesty on the part of three officers, if in fact that videotape showed what the court's opinion says it showed. But you're seeing the court react to those terrible facts by saying you can disclose without even a court being involved. And the significance of that is that if a court is not involved, then the officers whose testimony is going to be disclosed may not even know that their testimony is being disclosed. Think of this, I think, the whole issue of Brady and the way case law is developing under Brady. Think of this as maybe an extension of the police reform movement. We are going to see Brady disclosures expand, not contract in the future. And in some places, we're going to see the police reform statutes that are being considered by and passed by state legislatures, we're going to see them include mandatory disclosures and perhaps even, we've seen it with some of them, public disclosures of Brady-type material. Our next case is another Brady case that deals with prosecutorial immunity in Brady issues. And I think it's the same theme. And the theme is we want more, not less, in the way of Brady disclosures. Because when you read the court's opinion in this case, it looks like some pretty clear overreaching by a prosecutor. I'll see what you think in just a moment. And the court nonetheless says the prosecutor is immune from lawsuit. So what's this case all about? This comes out of Tennessee, and this is, by the way, a federal court of appeals opinion, so it's pretty significant. Working for the Fairview, Tennessee Police Department is Lieutenant Pat Stopdale, And Lieutenant Stockdale becomes concerned about the department's relationship with a couple of private security firms. And in particular, he suspected that some officers had falsified documents to obtain secondary employment with these private security outfits. He related these concerns to Kim Helper. She's the district attorney for Williamson County in Tennessee. And he told Ms. Helper that the wrongdoing had reached a whole new level and asked Helper to refer the matter to the State Bureau of Investigation. Well, 2 weeks later, the police chief announces his retirement. Helper decides she wants to get involved in who the successor is going to be to the chief, even though she's a county employee, and we're talking about the city police department. Her thoughts about who should be chiefs did not include Stockdale or a fellow lieutenant, a lieutenant by the name of Shane Dunning, both of whom she described as, quote, wannabe chiefs, end quote. She sent a text to an associate offering to go to bat for her candidate and texted, quote, God help us if it's Dunning or Stockdale. A few weeks later, the City of Fairview Board of Commissioners holds a meeting, and the city manager requested at the meeting that the Williamson County Sheriff investigate the police department. And in fact, what the city manager wants is an investigation, it turns out, of Stockdale and Dunning, because he places Stockdale and Dunning, the two lieutenants, on administrative leave. This is a little complicated. Stay with me. Try to follow the ball on this one. I had to read this opinion a couple of times before I figured out what was going on. So the city manager put Stockdale and Dunning, who the DA doesn't like, on administrative leave. Helper, the DA, why don't I just call her the DA? The DA tells a colleague of hers that her candidate now has a better shot. And the sheriff's department ends up issuing a report that includes allegations of criminal conduct. What's the criminal conduct? That Stockdale used a credit card to break into a building and then assaulted someone. That's what the sheriff's department reports. However, the DA doesn't bring any charges against anybody. Stockdale and Dunning, the two lieutenants, then sue the city and several other people. And they are essentially alleging whistleblowing because they say, look, we reported the problem with the falsified documents in the private security outfit, and we have been retaliated against. We've been placed on administrative leave because of this. And in the interim, while this lawsuit is pending, old city manager goes away, new city manager is hired. The new city manager looks at the sheriff's department report and says, unsubstantiated, and that the report did not justify taking any action against either of the lieutenants. So the lieutenants are then reinstated by the city manager. Kind of in the background, the detective, the sheriff's detective who led the investigation, is texting and with the DA. This is really small town, and I'm guessing small town Tennessee may be really small town, right? And the detective texts the DA saying, Pat and Shane, those are the two lieutenants, will get dollars. The DA says, how are they getting dollars? They've been on paid leave. And the detective explained that the lawsuit had been settled. Helper, the DA responds, thanks. I still won't take their cases. So not sure how that, getting the dollars, will help them. And the DA then writes the city manager, the new city manager, and says, we have concerns about the reports of Lieutenants Dunning and Stockdale. She actually demotes them to officers in her message. So we're going to be required to turn over that sheriff's investigation, the one that you've concluded is unsubstantiated. We're going to turn that over to any criminal defense counsel in a case where the lieutenants are involved. And without corroboration from another law enforcement officer, their testimony could be impeached. The new city manager showing his spine or lack thereof says, look, I disagree with your assessment, but if you're not going to withdraw it, I'm going to fire the two lieutenants. And he does. And he explains that the email is the sole reason. So the two lieutenants then sue the DA and the city. They settled their claims against the city. They probably got more dollars, I would think. And that left a First Amendment claim and various state law claims against the district attorney. The First Amendment claim is she's retaliating against them again because they are whistleblowing. There's a little bit of a problem with that lawsuit because she's not the employer, and usually only employers are responsible for damages for whistleblowing, but never mind that. The case ends up at the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and it has to decide, is the DA immune from lawsuit for placing the two lieutenants on her Brady list? And the DA says, number one, I'm entitled to absolute immunity because prosecutorial immunity, immunity given to prosecutors for decisions they make in their role as prosecutor, that is absolute immunity. That means our immunity as prosecutors can't be lost even if we act maliciously, even if we do things that are dishonest. We still have absolute immunity. And the court says, too far. The key to prosecutorial immunity, the court says, is advocacy. Whether or not the prosecutor is taking the actions in question as those of an advocate. And that means it has to be connected with the conduct of a trial or administrative conduct that is leading up to a trial. And the court says, and I'm quoting, because we grant absolute immunity only sparingly, officials seeking its ironclad protection bear the burden of showing that qualified immunity does not suffice. And then in a line, this is a bizarrely written court opinion. It's almost colloquial in the way it is written. Here's the next line. You'll see what I mean. The court says, and I'm quoting, and this is a direct quote, think of qualified immunity as a face mask and absolute immunity as a vaccine, with the presumption that qualified immunity is fit for the job. So the court says, no absolute immunity for you, DA. Now let's turn to qualified immunity. And this is the same qualified immunity that is the subject of all the police reform discussions around the country. And the defense of qualified immunity applies if you have a public employee, and the DA is a public employee, who violated constitutional guarantees that were clearly established at the time the public employee acted. So the court says, the question here is when the DA put these two lieutenants on her Brady list and communicated that fact to their employer in seemingly a deliberate attempt to get them fired, was she acting on the basis or did she violate constitutional guarantees that were clearly established? And the court said, no, she didn't. She is shielded by qualified immunity. Why? Even though the DA didn't happen to look at the law before she did what she did, what she would have seen had she looked at the law is a, quote, tangle of cases about absolute immunity, most of which favored the prosecutor. That it has taken us numerous pages in the Federal Reporter to make sense of the issue sends a signal that liability is far from clearly established. Ask then, says the court, what the DA would have seen when it comes to retaliation claims and the liability of decision makers, the city manager, versus non-decision makers, the DA. Recall that she did not have the authority to fire the lieutenants. She was not the decision maker. That matters. And the court says she's shielded by qualified immunity. Therefore, the lieutenants lose their lawsuit against the district attorney. This is pretty overreaching behavior by the district attorney, right? This is the sort of stuff that you would think would be the basis of a lawsuit, but it's not. And I keep returning to this theme, we're, I think, going to see more and more of this, more Brady disclosures and more protections given prosecutors for making Brady disclosures, even when the prosecutors are behaving badly, as in this case. I just realized I don't have any firefighter cases for you this month. There's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, the flow of court opinions has significantly slowed down, and I think that's an impact of the pandemic. I think courts are just simply greatly, greatly backlogged, and they're not getting to their opinions. And secondly, firefighters are just, you know, increasingly much less litigious than law enforcement officers. There are just not that many cases. When I say the flow has slowed down, normally on any given day, through search strings that we have created on Westlaw, which is our legal research service, on any given day, I might have to read as many as 15, 20, 25 court opinions, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. The opinions just keep on coming. But the word read in quotes, because many of them you can skim and decide whether or not they're useful or not useful. Now I think I'm down to 5 to 10 opinions in a day, and it seems to be staying at that level. So we just don't have as many decisions coming down as we used to. Get ready once the dam breaks for just an overwhelming number of cases. So with that, my next case is another police case. And I realized in picking the cases I wanted to talk about this month, I realized it had been a long time since I talked to you about Garcetti versus Ceballos and this amazing case that the Supreme Court decided more than a decade ago, an amazing case that pretty much says that public employees have no free speech rights associated with their jobs, for speech that is related to their jobs. It's not quite that broad, but it is fairly broad. The specific holding in Garcetti is that if a public employee engages in speech that arises out of their job, that speech is not protected by the First Amendment without regard to the content. It doesn't matter if that speech is of the utmost public importance. It does not matter if that speech is true. It does not matter if that speech is about corruption or is of the nature of whistleblowing. The First Amendment, the Supreme Court told us, does not provide employees protection if the speech arises out of the job. Now, Garcetti is a court opinion that's going to be with us for a long time. It was a 5-4 decision when it was issued, with the five conservatives on the Supreme Court lining up in the majority. And today, we have a 6-3 conservative majority on the Supreme Court. So expect Garcetti to be with us for a long time, particularly since some of the members of that six-person court majority are very young. So what is this new case that's come down that I want to use to illustrate to you the scope of the Garcetti decision? This comes out of Michigan, comes out of Saginaw County in Michigan, and it involves a detective who seized $22,583 in cash. Detective John Butcher seized that much money in cash during a narcotics investigation. When the suspect agreed to forfeit the money seized from him in lieu of formal civil forfeiture proceedings, the detective, Detective Butcher, delivers the money to Garrett DeWise. And DeWise, who's going to be the plaintiff in this case, is a deputy sheriff who is the department's property and evidence room manager. So DeWise takes the $22,583 in cash, and he books it as evidence or somewhere. He logs it appropriately. A few weeks later, Butcher comes to DeWise and says, look, I'd like $2,000 of that money to pay for confidential informants and controlled substance buys. DeWise refused. He said, this is not what this money is for. I think this use is improper. But then a lieutenant intervenes and orders DeWise to release the money, and he did. And over the next year, Butcher came back to the property room to make similar withdrawals from the $28,000 until they were depleted. And for each dispersal, both DeWise and Butcher signed a chit sheet. You don't want to say that too fast. A chit sheet documenting the date and amount of money that was withdrawn. After the funds were depleted, the Lieutenant Butcher, DeWise, and the finance director in the controller's office all had a big meeting to discuss Butcher's use of the funds. The sheriff then asked, after the meeting, DeWise to compile information for an annual report to the state of Michigan related to the department's civil forfeiture activity. The undersheriff, who would have normally prepared that report, was out sick. So DeWise had to go around and get some information relating to the prior year's forfeiture and communicate with the state about that issue. When compiling the information, DeWise once again looked at the whole issue of the forfeiture money and decided that it had been mishandled. And he did his own research, and he determined that civil forfeiture funds had to be deposited with the treasurer or with the county itself. But the funds from the bust that that Butcher deposited were off the books, to his mind, meaning they wouldn't be accounted for in the annual report. DeWise became afraid that this was going to reflect poorly on him because the report wouldn't balance out with the forfeiture data. And he became to believe that Butcher's actions were illegal. So DeWise then meets with the finance director. And during the meeting, DeWise talks about these forfeiture monies. And in response to that meeting, the department demotes. You're waiting for me to say Butcher, aren't you? No. They demote DeWise from his role in the property room. DeWise eventually leaves the department for a position with a different police agency and files a First Amendment retaliation claim against the county. And the question for the federal Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals under Garcetti versus Sabalos is a pretty straightforward one. When DeWise met with the finance director and disclosed all of his concerns about the use of the forfeiture money, and that's the meeting that appears to have prompted his demotion, were his statements made in the course of his job as a deputy sheriff? If they were, under Garcetti, the statements would be unprotected by the First Amendment. And now I'm going to quote to you from Garcetti, so you know how broad this is. Under Garcetti, quote, when public employees make statements pursuant to their official duties, the employees are not speaking as citizens for First Amendment purposes, and get ready, and the Constitution does not insulate their communications from employer discipline. The Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, looking at that, says, you know, you got to consider all the factors of the speech. You got to look at what the motivation was for the speech, what the setting was, what the subject matter was, who the audience was. Here, the motivation was DeWise was concerned with his professional reputation and whether he was doing his job. And that means his speech was, quoting, animated far more by his role as an employee than a member of the public at large. The setting was a meeting to discuss the financial practices of the sheriff's department, and the audience the finance director, both of those suggest that this was part of DeWise's job. To be sure, the finance director was not one of DeWise's direct supervisors, and the court admits that speech outside the chain of command is less likely to be protected, but the court says the most important thing here is that he communicated this information pursuant to his official job duties. And because he did, the speech is unprotected by the First Amendment, and it was perfectly permissible from the perspective of the First Amendment to demote DeWise. Now, might DeWise have had other job protections? Maybe. The opinion doesn't indicate whether he's covered by a collective bargaining agreement, nor does it indicate whether he was covered by civil service. He might have had some other job protections. What he does not have is a First Amendment lawsuit. And the court ends its opinion with something, and forgive me if I'm being cynical, but what I think is a cynical comment. And I'm going to quote from the court's opinion. In reaching this outcome, we do not question DeWise's motivation, nor do we condone disciplining public employees for raising concerns about government mismanagement or corruption. But in this public employment setting, laudable intent alone is not enough to secure First Amendment protection. And the court's right. That's what Garcetti versus Ceballos says. I want to close this podcast with another case that comes to us from Michigan. And it deals with a question that you see arising a lot in discrimination lawsuits, race discrimination, gender discrimination, whatever the form of discrimination might be. Under discrimination statutes, whether it's Title VII of the Civil Rights Act or whether it's a state anti-discrimination law, one of the things that a plaintiff, someone who's complaining of discrimination, must prove is that they suffered adverse employment action or suffered from an adverse employment action. And a question that you see come up with a great deal of frequency in these cases is, what is an adverse action? What is sufficiently adverse to support a discrimination lawsuit? In this case, which comes out of the Detroit Police Department, raises the question of whether a written reprimand, is enough to base a discrimination lawsuit upon. Is it sufficiently adverse? So what's going on here? This case involves a police officer by the name of Adela Green. Green is African American. She's supervised by Lieutenant James Cashin, who is white. On April 16th of 2016, Green and her partner were dispatched to address debris that was falling from an abandoned building somewhere in Detroit that was creating a traffic hazard. Cashin gets to the scene first. He deploys barricades to block a lane on Michigan Avenue in Detroit, which is a big thoroughfare. And according to his activity log, Cashin has a conversation with Green and her partner when they show up about taking too long a time to block traffic when a better course of action could have been taken. Well, in that interaction, there are different versions of the interaction. Green says Cashin grabbed her arm and berated her, that she broke loose from his grip, ran around to her police car, and sat inside. That Cashin followed her to the police car, squatted down, grabbed her by her thigh and her arm, and began violently shaking her as if he was trying to pull her out of the police car. Later on, not at the moment, but actually sometime afterward, Green expands on this and characterizes the incident as Cashin touching her, quote, inappropriately on my upper thigh and my vagina. Green's police partner, who was sitting at the car at the time, largely corroborated what Green had to say. So an internal affairs investigation is cranked up. And after interviewing everybody and looking at a number of documents, and the internal affairs investigation concluded that Green, not Cashin, should be disciplined, that the charges against Cashin should be dismissed, and Green should be disciplined for exhibiting insubordination and disrespect to her ranking officer when she walked away from Cashin at the scene, telling him she didn't have to listen to him, and for failing to truthfully answer all questions when being interviewed by IA. Part of the problem was, of course, that Green's description of what physically happened would pretty much have been impossible given the police car in question. Cashin wouldn't have been able to reach in the way that she claimed. Green initially gets a 5-day suspension. I looked at that and I thought, wow, that's interesting. Insubordination, disrespect, and untruthfulness, and you get a 5-day suspension. And that 5-day suspension was reduced to a written reprimand solely for the issue of insubordination. They do things differently in Detroit. I'll tell you, up in the Pacific Northwest, you're insubordinate, you're probably getting something north of a written reprimand. Well, Green is not happy with her written reprimand, and she files a lawsuit, not under Title VII, but under Michigan's anti-discrimination law. And she alleges, in part, she had a lot of claims in this lawsuit, that her reprimand was the product of race and sex discrimination. And the case goes to the Michigan Court of Appeals, and the court says, we can toss this case out pretty quickly. And the reason is because the reprimand is not sufficiently adverse to support a discrimination lawsuit. The court said, look, it's possible a written reprimand could be sufficiently adverse. It depends upon what the consequences are, the collateral consequences are of the written reprimand. But it's also possible that a written reprimand is not sufficiently adverse if there are no collateral consequences. So I'm going to quote to you from the court's opinion here. The court says, look, in order to be, it doesn't say look, that's me. The court says, in order to be actionable, an employment action must be materially adverse to the employee. That is, it must be more than a mere inconvenience or minor alteration of job responsibilities. There must be an objective basis for demonstrating that the employment action is adverse, and employees' subjective impressions are not controlling. Here, there's no evidence, the court says, that Green's discipline altered the circumstances and conditions of Green's employment at all, let alone materially. She provided no evidence that she had been overlooked for, denied a promotion or a transfer, no evidence that she'd been prevented from going back to the job duties she had prior to the incident, no evidence of a loss of wages or salary or any other alteration of her employment that wouldn't have otherwise occurred. And the court ends up concluding, quote, Green's subjective belief that the disciplinary process was flawed or discriminatory was insufficient to demonstrate that it was an adverse action, absent objective evidence demonstrating this. This case is not an outlier at all. I think this is the way pretty much every court in the country would rule on this. One comment that I do want to make about this case, just in passing, what's this case doing in state court? Why is Green not in federal court litigating this case? And this is something you're going to see more and more of, I think, in the future, as federal courts have turned so conservative on employment issues, and so conservative with, cases coming out differently today than they would have been when I started doing this podcast several years ago, as the courts have just gotten more pro-employer. I think what happened, I don't know, it's not in the opinion, I think what happened is Green's lawyer looked at the local federal court there in Detroit, looked at the judges, researched them, looked at their track record on discrimination cases, realized that there was a state law that was the functional equivalent of Title VII, looked at the judges in Michigan and said, I know where I'd rather be here. I'd rather be in state court under this state statute. You're going to see that decision made more and more over the course of the next few years. I'm sure I'll be dictating podcast articles about that on in a wide variety of different circumstances. So with that, thank you for joining us, and thank you for listening to a podcast. And when I'm sure everybody has a lot more to do right now, let's hope the next month brings a little bit more calm and peace than we have had in the last 6 months, 8 months. I think we all need it. And I, for one, am hoping that no more flammable bombs are thrown through the windows of my office. Is that too much to ask? I don't think so. With that, this is Will Aitchison signing off.